The largest wildfire in the history of Los Angeles County continues to burn today. The fire in the Angeles National Forest, which officials said is the result of arson, has destroyed more than 60 homes and taken the lives of two firefighters. Officials say it could be as long as 2 weeks before the fire is brought under control. Wildfires are becoming almost a yearly occurrence in California, which has been struck by drought for 3 years. That's strained the resources of the state's insurance industry and led some insurance companies to seek rate hikes from state regulators. We're joined now by the California Insurance Commissioner, Steve Poizner. He's on the phone from his office in Sacramento. Welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you.
How much of an effect have the wildfires had on insurance rates?
Well, not very much so far. I've been insurance commissioner here in California for about 2.5 years. It's an elected position, and overall, homeowners' insurance rates have gone down $700 million since 2007. Now, there are some rates that are starting to move the other direction now, but overall, it looks like things are just flattening out. The way rate setting works is that these insurance companies take into consideration the likelihood of catastrophes like wildfires, and so it's built into their rate structure. The only thing that would affect rates would be wildfires causing damage that go beyond the expectations. But so far, even though these wildfires have just been terrible and that any loss of any homes is just a tragedy for these homeowners, there's only been about 100 homes that have been lost in the last few months. Thank goodness. The firefighters here are doing a tremendous job, so I really don't expect much impact on rates yet.
And I think maybe the operative word may be yet, because large wildfires are breaking out much more often than in the past. Do you think there might be a preemptive rise in rates as insurers anticipate more fire claims?
Well, the way it works is that they need my permission, my sign-off for changing rates. The rates are set, looking at multi-year trends. Overall, that's how insurance companies operate. They collect premiums year after year after year, anticipating that certain years are going to be worse than others. So far, my rate analysts and my financial analysts, we've come to the conclusion that there really hasn't been any unexpected damage, and that's the key.
Is it difficult for homeowners who live in heavily wooded areas like the Angeles National Forest or in rural communities to get insurance because of the fire risk?
Some areas it's tougher than others, that's for sure. But there are about 200 insurance companies offering homeowners insurance in California. But if you are turned down 3 times or more, then by law you can go into the high-risk fire insurance pool. And there's currently about 15,000 homeowners that obtain insurance from the FAIR plan, which is the high-risk pool that's operated on a break-even basis by the insurance industry.
And the FAIR plan, it stands for Fair Access to Insurance Requirements, and it offers coverage, as you said, to homeowners who can't otherwise get insurance, especially in those wildfire areas. But, California is in tough financial shape right now. Can it does the state continue to afford that plan?
Well, yes. It's been in existence since about the 1960s. The plan is designed to break even. If the plan needs more money, then it will assess the other private insurance companies. It doesn't cost the state of California anything. I oversee its operation as the insurance commissioner, but it has substantial reserves, and it operates pretty effectively so far. And fortunately, between the FAIR plan, which only offers 15,000 policies, combined with the private sector, which offers close to 20 million homeowners insurance policies, anyone in the state of California can and will get homeowners insurance here.
Steve Poizner is California Insurance Commissioner. He spoke to us from his office in Sacramento. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Now an update to a story we featured last month on this program. It's about dolphin hunting in Taiji, Japan. The hunt was supposed to begin this week. It hasn't, and we'll explain why in a moment, but first, some background. We interviewed the director of a new documentary called The Cove. He and his team went undercover in Taiji to illegally film a secret cove where every year some 20,000 dolphins are trapped and then speared to death by fishermen. Here's a clip from the film.
Hundreds of thousands of dolphins have died there. You'll see the signs, "Keep out." The fishermen told me, they said, if the world finds out what goes on here, we'll be shut down. imagine that? They actually told us that.
That's environmental activist Rick O'Berry. He's the subject of the documentary. He used to be the dolphin trainer on the 1960s TV show Flipper. And that experience turned him into an advocate for dolphins. Now, for much of his life, Rick Berry's tried to tell the world about what happens at the cove in Taiji. He argues that there's no economic reason to kill the dolphins. Their meat is highly toxic and dangerous as food or fertilizer. The director of the film, Luis Cejollos, can't return to Japan because there's an arrest warrant out for him. He trespassed to film the hunt. Here's a clip from our interview we aired last month. The slaughter will begin in September. I mean, it's going to start again.
Unless we stop it, yes. I'm not going to, you know, predict when it's going to stop. It will stop. You know, I'd like to be a catalyst for that.
Well, the documentary, which won the Audience Award at the Sundance Film Festival, looks like it's working. Taiji's sister city, Broome, Australia, suspended its relationship with Taiji. And this week, activist Rick O'Berry went back to the cove along with a group of international journalists. I caught him on his cell phone yesterday as he traveled through Japan. He says he hasn't seen any hunting so far.
We showed up when the dolphin killing season began, September 1st. And they're thinking about what to do. Should we go out? Should we be exposed? The world is watching. And so far, they haven't killed any dolphins.
On that day, Rick O'Berry blogged, "Today is a very good day for dolphins."
I think maybe it's over. I'm hoping it's over, that they'll just give up and stop killing dolphins here.
What happens when you and all the international press leave Taiji? I mean, are you worried that the dolphin hunters will sort of breathe a sigh of relief and then just carry on with the slaughter?
Yeah, we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen. It's a day-by-day thing here, you know. We just don't know.
That's anti-dolphin hunting activist Rick O'Berry, who's featured in the new documentary, The Cove. For more on the film, visit thenewnpr.org.
For the first time since World War II, Florida is losing population. University of Florida demographers recently reported that the number of residents dropped by more than 58,000 last year. Essayist and Florida native Diane Roberts considers the implications.
Florida has always had a tenuous relationship with reality. In the 1880s, we convinced the ailing and infirm that Florida was good for their health, despite the mosquitoes and the suffocating heat. In the 1920s, we sold swampland to Yankees, promising that with just a little draining and a little fill dirt, it could be paradise. We call ourselves the Sunshine State, never mind that it rains an awful lot. The rest of America sold corn, cotton, iron, or coal. Florida sold itself. When you retired, you were going to where there was no snow to shovel, where you could pick oranges off trees growing in your backyard, and flowers bloomed in winter. Taxes were low, living was high. Florida was Eden on the cheap. It was bound to catch up with us. Gary Mormino, a distinguished historian of Florida, says our whole economy is more or less one big Ponzi scheme. The state funds its roads and schools by bringing in new investors, that is, new residents, to pay sales taxes and property taxes. When nobody can afford a condo in Boca, when tourists stop coming, even for a week at Disney World, the Ponzi scheme collapses. Now it seems as though everybody here knows somebody who has left, is leaving, or wants to leave. Even the governor wants to leave for Washington, D.C. He's running for the U.S. Senate after one term. I'm not too upset people are bailing out of Florida. I never believed in the state religion that growth was good. Florida will be poorer, but quieter. The old inhabitants will be just fine. Bees are colonizing empty houses in bankrupt suburbs. Alligators and frogs are taking up residence in abandoned swimming pools. Wetlands will reassert themselves. Muscadine vines, spiderwort, and pickerel weed will overrun the golf courses, and panthers will dance again in the forests. Maybe one day kudzu will enfold Cinderella's castle in its pitiless green embrace. Here, nature always wins. After all, Florida was the last part of the North American continent to emerge from the sea, and when the waters rise again, Florida will be the first to return.
Diane Roberts is author of Dream State, A History of Florida. This is NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Tomorrow marks the anniversary of a day that will live in economic infamy. On September 7, 2008, the federal government stunned financial markets by announcing its takeover of two mortgage giants, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. That was just the beginning of a wild series of events. In the weeks that followed, Bank of America took over Merrill Lynch, Lehman Brothers collapsed, credit markets froze up, insurance giant AIG got an $85 billion federal rescue, and financial markets all over the world went haywire. The Federal Reserve, Treasury, and Congress threw everything they could at the crisis, slashing interest rates and shoveling out hundreds of billions of dollars for rescue plans. In the coming days, NPR will revisit the events of last September to assess where we are today. NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn Giewax joins us to preview our series of reports called Financial Crisis, 1 Year and Counting. Welcome back, Marilyn.
Hi, Leanne.
Looking back to last September, was it really as bad as it seemed?
That was not media hype. When I look back on the events, the pace was just terrifying. You know, in the summer of 2008, we knew the economy was slipping into a recession. You could see that jobs were shrinking, home foreclosures were rising. But nobody was saying that by mid-September, financial giants like Lehman Brothers and Washington Mutual would be in complete ruins. You had the government racing from one crisis to the next, trying to save some of the best-known companies on Wall Street. I mean, Merrill Lynch is not some obscure hedge fund. These companies that were waking up dead were really the household names. And the other thing that was really strange was the remedies that the government was coming up with were equally jaw-dropping. Just take one example. You know how Congress is always so slow to actually get any legislation passed. But last September, the lawmakers just became so terrified about what was happening that they approved the Troubled Assets Relief Program. You remember TARP? That was a $700 billion rescue plan for banks, and they passed it in just a matter of days. By October 3rd, President Bush had already signed it into law.
Did all or any of those frantic efforts work?
I think you could fairly say that economists believe that the worst is definitely behind us. When you look at the stock market, it's been rising for about 6 months now, and the number of job cuts is down dramatically. Back in January, we were talking about 750,000 jobs being lost in 1 month. Well, on Friday, we just got new numbers about August, and it was only 216,000 jobs lost. Yes, okay, that's terrible, but the direction is going the right way. So economists say that the worst of it is wrapping up, really, and credit markets are stabilizing now.
Well, if that's what's behind us, what's in front of us?
Unfortunately, no matter how you look at this, you've got to admit that we've got tough times ahead of us. Even though companies aren't slashing their payrolls the way they were doing last winter, they aren't hiring yet. Economists think that the 9.7% unemployment rate is just going to keep rising for months, probably into next summer, maybe getting to about 10.3%. And those home foreclosure numbers are still horrifying. We're talking about millions of people who are going to lose their homes before this crisis really settles out. So commercial real estate is in the dumps, consumers aren't spending, the travel industry is still taking a beating. We just got into such a deep hole last year that even the optimists say it's going to take us years to climb out of this and get back to normal. So we really wanted to take a closer look at such a big event. We have reporters for National Public Radio are going to go back and look at what happened, talk to experts, and try to figure out where do we go from here. And one of the things we're trying to do with this is just assess the cost. What did it cost us in jobs lost, bankruptcies, foreclosures? and we want to add up some of the costs for taxpayers. What happened with all those bailouts? So our website, npr.org, they've put together charts and timelines, things that can help people understand what's happened over the past year.
NPR series of reports, Financial Crisis, 1 Year and Counting, begins this week. Marilyn Gwax is NPR's senior business editor. Thank you, Marilyn.
You're welcome.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Take a few elements of Star Wars. Add a touch of 2001. A dash of The Wizard of Oz. A hint of Blazing Saddles. Plus a pinch of public radio. Mix them up with the fertile imagination of a field producer for The Daily Show, and you end up with Michael Rubin's first novel, The Sheriff of Yharnamir. In this action-packed, alien-driven tale, Earth is only a memory. Every planet but one has corporate sponsorship. Yharnamir. Now see, if you say that slowly, it's your name here. Michael Rubins is in our New York bureau. Welcome to the program, Michael.
Hi, good to be here.
Can you give us just a brief synopsis of the book? I mean, pretend you're pitching it for a movie.
I think the briefest synopsis of the book is it's basically the story of a sort of failed wannabe space adventurer who, against his better judgment and will, ends up becoming the protector of a very eccentric community at the edge of the galaxy.
Mm-hmm. And this eccentric community is Yharnamir, and it's also thought to be mythical until we find out that it's not.
In the book, sort of, Yharnamir, the Your Name Heres have all been snatched up long ago, and so the final Your Name Here, the final unsponsored planet, is really, at this point, has become a myth. No one thinks that it really exists.
Mm-hmm. What was the genesis of this project for you? I mean, this is your first novel.
The initial idea came from sort of the trend that we see with sports stadiums where there's so few left that have like an organic name that it's related to the community or the team, and they all have corporate sponsors. And then it just seemed like the logical, absurd conclusion to that trend would be sponsored planets. And then I started thinking of, you know, a planet that didn't have a corporate sponsor and then a flawed hero to protect that planet.
Hmm. Do you identify with your main character, Cole, that flawed hero, that rogue who ends up being a good guy?
I sort of feel that I'm a compilation of all the characters' least flattering aspects.
I'm afraid to ask about Kenneth, then.
Right, without the tentacles.
Describe Kenneth.
Kenneth is a bounty hunter, and he is, in my imagination, he's almost indescribable. He's the most grotesque sort of alien that you could imagine with tentacles and claws and et cetera. But he's also a very jolly, cultured fellow. And he's always in such a good mood, generally.
Yeah, even when he's about to... Well, his whole thing with Cole is, for punishment for owing him money, decides to plant his eggs in Cole's brain.
Exactly. That is the threat that is hanging over Cole's head.
Yeah, yeah. Are you aware that by calling your hero Cole and your villain Kenneth, that if you put this two together, it's Kenneth Cole, which happens to be a brand name?
That had been pointed out to me, and it really never crossed my mind. And it seemed like such an obvious thing, especially in a book that comments about advertising and branding, to miss that obvious reference.
Mm. Explain the public radio element.
You know, he has obviously this love interest of Marianne, who's on the planet, and
this is Cole.
This is Cole, right? And she is an intergalactic public radio correspondent there, sort of, you know, reporting from there. And, you know, I grew up in a public radio household. I'm a fan of public radio, and it, not to brown nose, but it always sort of was, it was shorthand for like goodness and decency and culture.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose if you have a non-commercial planet, you might as well have non-commercial radio, right?
Oh, exactly.
Yeah. Why is Utopia, I mean, this planet of Yharnamir, so much like the Wild Wild West?
In a way, you know, science fiction and fantasy and westerns, there is something very similar about that. It's all about sort of there's this freedom and there's danger and guns and adventure. And I sort of like that setting. You know, there's so many stories of the stranger comes to town to save the town. And here was a chance to sort of limit technology. If you removed the technology in that setting and also the freaky aliens, you know, it's basically a western.
Kind of like Blazing Saddles when Cleavon Little comes into town and they build a fake town right. to fool the bad guys.
Exactly. It's sort of somewhere between Seven Samurai and Blazing Saddles.
Michael Rubin's new book is called The Sheriff of Yrnimir, and he joined us from our New York bureau. Thanks. Good luck with this.
Thank you very much for having me.
There's a saying that's familiar to everyone in Rwanda. It goes, God spends the day elsewhere, but he sleeps in Rwanda. The saying has a double meaning. It alludes to the country's physical beauty, but also to the brutality that has at times haunted Rwanda. The story of that country, from decolonization to the genocide to the present day, is told in a new memoir by Joseph Sebarenzi. Before he was sent into exile in 2000, Sebarenzi was the third most powerful man in the country. He was the Speaker of the Parliament. He now lives here in Washington, D.C., and Joseph Sebarenzi joins me in the studio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You grew up in a village that was mixed. There were Hutus and Tutsis. You yourself are a Tutsi. At what point in your life did you realize that there were actually ethnic differences and that this was something that you needed to be aware of?
It was in 1973, shortly before the massacres, and there was
These were massacres that left about 30,000
yes.
Rwandans dead.
Yes, and I was in the kitchen at night ready to have our dinner, and then my mother was upset, and she pointed a finger to me and said, did you know that I had to go in the bush with you when you were a baby?
In the bush.
In the bush. She said, because if we had stayed in house, we would have been killed. I said, by who? And she said, Hutu, why? She said, because we are Tutsi. I had no idea we're Tutsi. I had no idea what Hutu meant.
And you even asked her, who's a Hutu?
I did ask, and she mentioned some names.
But people that you knew, neighbors.
Yeah, people I knew. And my sister said, but these are good friends. They can't harm us. And the next day, and I saw it. I saw people with machetes running, shouting, and burning houses. But we left shortly before they got at our house, and the house was not spared.
There are stories in this book about how your Hutu neighbors helped save you at times, and at other times took part in the attacks.
So it's a paradox that the same people who protect us in 1973 from those killers, eventually in 1994, from that family, people harmed my family.
They were involved in the genocide in 1994, 90 days mm-hmm. that left 800,000 people, mainly Tutsis, dead, including your mother, your father, seven of your siblings, many of your relatives. You were in Canada at the time watching this all yeah. on television. Why did you decide to return to Rwanda after what happened to your family?
You know, it was a very difficult decision. I was in a very safe place, but I felt I had survived for a reason. I felt I had to go back to Rwanda, help in reconstruction, to make sure what had happened, it does not happen to Hutu and to Tutsi in future.
After the genocide, after you returned, you decided to enter politics, to get involved in government, and you had this astronomical rise. You became the Speaker of Rwanda's parliament at a very young age. What was it like to try and govern in a country so soon after one of history's greatest examples of genocide?
It was very difficult. It was so hard because people were still angry. There were revenge going on. There were human rights in many parts of the country. We were under basically a military regime. And as a Tutsi, as a survivor, as someone educated who had a chance to travel in many countries, I felt we had to do something. We had a president, but that president did not have much power. Kagame was really the power behind the throne.
Paul Kagame. Who at the time was the vice president.
Well, the vice president, but he was the most powerful person in the country.
He was the head of the Rwandan Patriotic Front, who had led an attack on the Hutu-dominated government that was carrying out this genocide. And we should mention Paul Kagame is currently the president of Rwanda.
Yes, he is.
You had a falling out with him. Eventually, Kagame accused you of being a threat to national security.
Mm-hmm.
You actually became afraid for your life. I mean, you didn't just resign as speaker. You had to leave the country.
A few days after I resigned, I learned from many sources that there was planned to kill me, and I decided to leave.
President Paul Kagame has been lauded by world leaders as an example, a model of a stable African leader. You are very, very critical of Paul Kagame in this book, almost accusing him of exercising dictatorial powers.
It's understated, actually. He's an autocrat. Just to give you some example, you never hear from Rwanda a political leader now who can stand and oppose any given policy. You don't have that. You don't have people go out and protest government policy. You are not allowed. So it's very tough.
But are government leaders in Rwanda dealing with issues of reconciliation that will prevent a future genocide from occurring?
No. If you look at Rwanda today, underneath, it's boiling. You cannot have reconciliation if you don't have justice on both sides. We need to come up with a formula that will make Hutu and Tutsi feel part of the system. That way, we can have a hope to have a lasting peace and reconciliation in Rwanda.
Joseph Seberenzi is the author of God Sleeps in Rwanda, which comes out this week. He joined us here in the studio. Mr. Seberenzi, thank you so much for your time.
It's a pleasure.
And you can read an excerpt from God Sleeps in Rwanda at thenewnpr.org.